Good morning. We're on chapter 2 of 3 presentations in this segment, what I call the value-oriented social institutions. Places where we learn not just, well, where we learn what we believe, maybe have our beliefs challenged. You know, that's part of my job, is to take a look at some of that kind of stuff, so that we can reflect on how we've come to this conclusion and what its strengths and limits are, and so on. Value-oriented social institutions. Family, today education, and on Thursday religion. Test is a week from today, the next test, same as always. You know, bring everything that you've done before, just keep on doing what we're doing. There's a review on Monday night at 6 in the chemistry building, room 49. We try to keep things consistent. So are there any questions about details? Logistics or anything like that? So far, so good? Okay. Well, this presentation includes more terms and definitions than usual, although I'll try to tie them together with some basic themes, also comparative perspectives. And then at the end of the presentation today, there's a film. It's a 15-minute clip from a book called Savage Inequalities, Children in America's Schools, and it illuminates the schools versus prisons deal. So that's what we've got. And let me just start by giving you a textbook definition of education, which is different than learning. Education and learning are different. And I have to tell you, that's one of my missions in life that's almost impossible to carry out, to try to help my students are facilitate a process where the grading doesn't get in the way of the learning. And that's a really uphill battle in a world that standardizes tests and highlights the value of the answer more than the question. But be that as it may, I think we'd learn pretty much all day, every day. There are things to be learned from everything we do. But education is, and here's the definition, a formal process of learning. A formal process of learning. And I got this out of a book, and it cracks me up every time I give the definition. A formal process of learning in which some persons consciously teach, and others take on the role of student. In other words, it's a drama. Where some persons consciously teach and others take on the role of student. I'll bet you've had a class where it seemed like your professor was teaching unconsciously, right? Or at least it seemed that way. It might as well have been. We try to consciously put forward ideas in a formalized and systematic way. And then you hold up your end by playing the role of student. You take notes, you look attentively, you ask questions, etc., etc. So there's in some sense a stage play going on here that formalizes the learning. It formalizes the learning. We call that education. And that level of formalization occurs in different ways and different levels of intensity, whether we're talking about primary education, secondary education, or higher education. And it's changing all the time, both how it is formalized and what the consequences of that decision and those types of decisions might be. So that's what education is. It's a formal process of learning in which some persons consciously teach and others take on the role of student. And the role of student implies expectations. That's the deal. Credentialism is the requirement that a person hold an advanced degree, The requirement that a person hold an advanced degree is a condition of employment. Hiring managers use this as a screening tool. It may not necessarily be the case that a job you earn the right to do when you graduate from college requires much of the specific things you learned in college as much as it requires the work ethic you've developed in college. That is, it's a screening tool for hiring managers. If you have successfully put up with all the hoops that we put you through, then we'll go ahead and hire you. Go ahead.
Okay, degree as a
condition of employment. Personal and advanced degree is a condition of employment. You can't get through the door for the interview unless you have this degree, whether or not anything you learned while getting that degree will help you on this job. My first job out of college was as a program director in a YMCA. Most of what I needed to know to do that job, I picked up doing the job. On the other hand, sociology degree helped me understand some of the dynamics going on between, you know, different levels of employees, people that worked for me. I supervised a whole pool staff, and I was supervised by a director, as it were. So, essentially, requiring that a person hold a degree as a condition of employment is a screening process. You can't get a tenure track or potentially tenurable job at a university, typically, without a PhD. Now, there are some subdisciplines for which that there are exceptions. A master of fine arts or a master's in music are considered terminal degrees. That is, that's the highest degree you need to earn in order to get that job. Mainstreaming is usually something that we think of in terms of primary education, and then it moves forward through public schools. It's the process of integrating handicapped or special needs kids, into what we might call regular classrooms. We mainstream kids who have special needs into mainstream classrooms wherever possible, and it isn't always possible. But the operative term here is trying to create an educational environment in the formal process of learning, what's referred to as the least restrictive environment for learning, So, you know, kids with special needs, emotional needs, intellectual needs, physical needs, they may be in special classes for reading and math, perhaps. And yet they may be mainstreamed for music and art. You know, who knows? But to the extent possible, mainstreaming involves an effort on the part of public school systems to create what's referred to as the least restrictive environment, Minimum competency tests. These are standardized tests which measure basic skills. Kind of an intriguing idea. And of course, since they're standardized, one size fits all, and that's just not true. You know, they call it the STAR test now, don't they? What does that stand for? Anybody know? Something, 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 something? Yeah, that's about right. I wish they would just go back to the TOCS test, which I really thought was explicit and appropriate and accurate, because I think these things are toxic. And my job is to detoxify you. What's the answer? I don't know. What question is worth asking? That's what you should figure out. What question is worth asking? I honestly believe that all my test questions are worth asking, because I believe that most of them require you to think a little bit before you answer, as opposed to simply retrieve something from memory without thinking it through. Now, obviously, that's not always the case, and it's different when I'm teaching another class where we do essay exams and so on. But minimum competency tests are used to implement this next process called tracking, which involves placing students in curriculum groups based on test scores. So the test scores come out, the TOCS test is taken, and depending on when it occurs, the next year students are either moved to the next grade or not, or when they're moved to the next grade, they're placed in low, middle, or high reading or math groups based on the results of these standardized tests. The problem, at least in the U.S., is that standardized tests turn 70% into gold, right? And I'm going to social promotion on this next point illustrates this in a different way. But before I get to that definition, we have created a learning process that's evaluated in this way, that school districts and superintendents and to some extent even particular teachers or groups of teachers are evaluated based on how well their kids do or their students do on these standardized tests, which does a couple of different things. It narrows the criteria that measures excellence, And it also encourages rampant cheating. And over the years, we have learned this in some pretty horrifying ways, that that big school districts have been found to have cooked the books or tipped the answers to some of these standardized tests just so that their funding doesn't get cut. Doesn't matter what the kids learned, apparently. It's how did the test scores on which their structure was based, how did they turn out? Social promotion means transferring or promoting students from one grade to the next based on age rather than performance. Based on age rather than performance. And it's a controversial idea. And it's one of those things that is criticized pretty profoundly with a seemingly rational soundbite. You shouldn't move a kid from second to third until the kid can do third grade work. Makes perfect sense. Sounds very reasonable. Until it takes them 3 years to learn how to do third grade work, and they're the age of a sixth grader becoming physically mature in a third grade classroom with much younger kids. And you have the potential, certainly, for bullying or even physical or, on occasion, even at that age, a kind of vulnerability to even sexual abuse. So at some point, you can't keep flunking a kid. I mean, there are lots of different reasons for that. But just simply because of the age factor and the sort of biological growth factor that create sometimes even dangerous environments. And here's the other thing. When you move a child from second grade to second grade again, they tend to do pretty well the second time around on second grade work. But unless the actual learning process has been jump-started a little bit, unless they learn how to learn better, or unless whatever special need they might have is addressed in a way that can help them learn better, they quickly fall behind in third grade. And by fourth grade, they're eligible for retention again. And pretty soon you've got a fifth grader that has reached his or her senior year, etc. So it's a difficult balancing act for public schools who are funded in ways that don't always provide resources to meet special needs of special kids. So that's a difficult one. Anyway, education, a formal process of learning whereby some consciously teach and others take on the role of learner or student. Credentialism, the requirement that a person hold an advanced degree as a condition of employment. Mainstreaming, the integrating of special needs or handicapped children into regular classrooms. Minimum competency tests are standardized tests that measure basic skills, the toxic ones. Tracking involves placing students into curriculum groups based on these test scores, and social promotion involves moving students from one grade to the next based on age in addition to or maybe even instead of academic performance. So far, so good? Make flashcards. Well, how does this work? How does a successful society use the educational process to promote stability, order, efficiency, and consensus? Schools transmit culture and continue to socialize us. They reinforce prevailing norms of gender role socialization, for one thing. And they also continue to instill the kinds of values that we collectively believe all kids in school should have and live by and even proclaim. Think back to elementary school now. Pick a grade, third, fourth, fifth, it doesn't matter. For how many of you in that grade and at that time did each day begin with either the Pledge of Allegiance or the National Anthem? Most of you. For how many of you did you stand at the time that was done? So I guess you quit standing for that when you get to college, right? I cracked myself up. For how many of you in a public school did the start of the day include not just a patriotic event, but also a religious one, a prayer or a moment of silence in a public school? How many of you went to a public high school? And we're talking about now just within the last 4 or 5 years at most, usually for many of you just last year. How many of you at your graduation ceremony did a religious event take place? And was Jesus' name mentioned? And nobody called the FBI? Because in fact, that's violation of federal law. Lashma. We'll get to that on Thursday in a little more detail. It's just kind of interesting to me how the values we cherish so much that they sometimes conflict with other values. We want to teach our high school graduates to be good law-abiding citizens, and we send them out of their graduation event having violated federal law. Yeah, but that's not a very important federal law. In fact, it's a stupid one, and we shouldn't have it. So we just choose not to obey that one. Get the idea on how this, you know, I'm not even here to adjudicate or even try to debate that question. I just think it's interesting that we transmit culture, socialize, and reinforce the values we cherish, and almost nobody questions it. And if anybody does question it, usually, especially if it's in a small town, and I would say Post-Texas is one of them, and they do this every year, it's usually like the one Jewish family that's just moved into town, and the dad is something of an activist and cries foul. And as soon as one person cries foul, it goes away. It always does. And then that person is vilified in town, like for the rest of their lives. That story sound familiar to anybody? Okay. Public education also serves to integrate. And, I mean, once again, I'm sort of salad barring you with what we do in this discipline. And I'm going to illustrate these points in ways that are all over the map. Sometimes the illustration involves kindergarten. Sometimes the illustration involves graduate school. But the principles are the same throughout. Integration is essentially an effort to assimilate. Let's put it that way. It's an effort to have the public school system help assimilate. And one of the ways that this occurs, in fact, maybe the most profound way that it occurs, is through the resistance of bilingual education, the idea that everybody in a public school should primarily speak English or at least be given remedial training or being brought up to speed, if English is not their native language, as soon as possible. That we get everybody on the same page speaking as much English as possible as quickly as we can for the purposes of integration. Now, this actually works pretty well. Public schools have integrated and socialized families for generations, whether they came from Italy or Germany or Mexico or Spain or France or any other place. It's the kids that have helped teach even parents and grandparents the new language. You know, and there may be people in this room that as 5, 6, and 7-year-olds, you know, helped teach abuelo a little bit of English. You know, maybe. I don't know. But that's, in part, one of the functions of public education, is to make sure that we try to get most people on most of the same page most of the time, culturally. Social placement is kind of interesting. It's an effort by public education to create the workforce that the country needs. In other words, to make sure we have enough engineers and scientists and doctors and clergy and lawyers, as well as enough, you know, secretaries and accountants and mid-level managers, as well as enough steel workers and punch press operators and floor sweepers and lawn planters, if you will. And so there's a placement process that arguably still comes out of standardized testing, but at least more or less cut points at 70th percent, at the 70th percentile. If your test scores are not, certainly not there minimally and somewhat beyond, counselors will not typically say to high school kids, you know, you ought to try college. You shouldn't try college unless your test scores are above a requisite level, and that requisite level sort of changes. And in America, we mostly allow most everyone to try. If not at a state research university like this one, certainly the University of Phoenix will take anybody. And if you, I mean, seriously, that's what they do. And if you can get some federal grant money to go, that's great. And if you'd only make it a year, at least they get the grant money or the loan money. And that's how they're making the kind of money they are. Don't get me started on the shift in higher education toward online excellence. Don't get me started. But anyway, you're looking at a dinosaur, ladies and gentlemen. I'm a tenured full professor teaching a class of 300 freshmen. That will not happen, maybe ever again. But I resist. I want to do this. I think it's important. It's important to you. So anyway, I digress. But the Germans have turned this into an art form. At or around middle school, every German public education student is given a battery of standardized tests, and they are tracked into one of four, as it turns out, levels of secondary education. One is sort of special ed and remedial. The other three involve sort of manual labor or sort of mid-level management or college prep and professional. And that's called Gymnasium. The German high school is, the name of it in German is Gymnasium. I don't know why it is, but that's just what it is. And typically, Gymnasium graduates are a little bit older than American high school graduates, and they have, as a result of the Gymnasium educational process, a couple of years, more like college sophomore level learning than, as compared to American high school graduates. And then, you know, there are the other two. And the point is that particular country has created an educational process that gives the culture the workforce and professional expertise that it needs to function. And, you know, German culture literally wrote the book on structural functionalism. They make things work. The extent to which it works for one or the other, less important. Not irrelevant, but less important. So that's what social placement is about. It's trying to use the educational process to create a workforce or to generate a workforce that that accomplishes what needs to be done. Social control is a kind of anticipatory socialization. We defined that term a month or so ago. That in school, for example, we learn that if we're late, if we're tardy, we're subject to getting a detention. If we get into a fight on the playground, we go to the principal's office and we're punished in some way. If we don't turn in our work, you know, we're punished in a different way, a detention or some extra homework or something. And when we learn that that's true, we are ready to learn that when you have this job, especially if your job is to operate a punch press in a factory, you have to punch in at 7 o'clock. And if you punch in at 7:03, we'll dock you 6 minutes' pay, a tenth of an hour's pay. And so punctuality is important. And you learn that as a kid when you get a detention for being tardy. When you are suspended for fighting, you learn that, well, in an adult society, you won't get suspended. You might get arrested and jailed for getting into a fight, as it were. So, you know, we're learning that the same sorts of behaviors that adults are punished for, our kids are punished for as well. There's a level of social control that goes with it. You don't, you know, please remain in your seats until the bell rings or some such thing. Fair enough? Social change. It's a negotiated process, a negotiated and evolving process that that education sort of brings to brings about change in a culture. It is certainly true, and this has been negotiated and it's evolved over many years, that a history textbook, for example, and the curriculum in a history class or a social studies class in, you know, junior year of high school looks much different, and the content of the book is much different in 2013, let's say, than it was, say, in 1953. Especially with regard to the role of women in general, certainly the role of women in the workforce, and also issues related to race and culture. All of that in a textbook in 1950 would be much different. It would be much more or much less diverse. Diversity would be much less an issue for curriculum study and even social critique than it would be in a textbook, a history or social studies textbook in 2013. So social change, again, in much the same way we talked about social change in the entertainment industry when we talked about deviance, where what was deviant 50 years ago with Elvis on the Ed Sullivan Show to now what is normative in some way when you have Miley Cyrus and the Wrecking Ball or something like that, and how different that is. With some limits and so on. I mean, I think aren't there two versions of the Wrecking Ball video, and one is more skin than another? I don't know. Nobody knows. Nobody cares. There's what? They call it the director's cut. Okay, that's the one you want to look at. But you don't want to show it to your little sisters and brothers. Okay. So social change is negotiated. It evolves slowly, and we put limits on every incremental step forward. And the issue, I think, that illustrates that better but also by way of analogy in the entertainment industry, are history and social studies textbooks and their depictions of issues related to race and gender. Finally, cultural innovation. And again, I told you I would illustrate each of these points in some sense from a kindergarten classroom, and some from a middle school, some from high school. This one is college. As teachers, and especially as college professors, although this is true for all teachers, we are taught that innovation is a good thing. You know, my granddaughter's first grade teacher is trying to hustle up some money from her kids' grandparents, which would be me, and all of the other kids, and I'm all in on it to make sure that each kid has some kind of a device, whether it's a Kindle or an iPad or some such thing, because there are learning apps now that this teacher is especially familiar with and especially adept at using to teach reading. And Lily, my granddaughter, I watched her, you know, use one of these apps on an iPad mini, and it's rather remarkable. There are three, you know, it's a reading thing, and there are three different settings you can use. The iPad can read to the kid can read to the iPad and have it recorded and then read back. And then there's also a comprehension function where questions are asked. Then the student, even the first grader, now has to read the question, but then answer the comprehension question. It's pretty remarkable. So, you know, that's an innovative thing. At the college level, especially since this is a major research university, for better or worse, you get, at least in theory, excuse me, you get, in theory, exposure to ideas or findings from the research that your teachers are conducting, because we are paid to do three things. We're paid to sit on committees and hold up our end in service to the university, and that's fairly easy to do. We're paid to teach, and we're evaluated by you on how well that's working out. And to some extent, we are sanctioned, you know, for how well we do that. Although the bar for teaching satisfactorily at a university like this is not very high. Most people can clear that, you know, by showing up and putting forward an honest effort at the curriculum and so on. What we are rewarded most for, however, is conducting research, especially if we can hustle up the money to pay ourselves to do it. That's the big reward. Well, the purpose in that is both cost-effective for the university, but it also entices us to teach you things that nobody else will learn. And specifically in Thursday's lecture, I'm going to show you stuff that pretty much nobody else knows unless they've hit our website, and it's been up. There's a presentation piece on religion and deviance that I'm going to show you that's been up on our website, but our website doesn't get a lot of hits. Our moral community study webpage does not get a lot of hits. And so, you know, there may have been somebody that ran into it by accident. But mostly I'm going to show you something that's not published yet and hasn't been widely known and understood in the same way. And in some ways it overstates the obvious, but in other ways there's a couple of nuances that I think are kind of important. So whether you value it or not, or whether it's important to you or not, you at least have the opportunity to be taught here by people that are at least in theory doing innovative things. Was that enough qualifiers to that sentence? In theory and in principle and at least more or less? Okay. I will tell you this, that the single day of my college educational process that I remember most, and there were only about 10 days that I remember this vividly at all, but the one I remember most vividly had nothing to do, it was in a class, it had nothing to do with what was on the table to be taught that day in that class. It was an advanced chemistry class. This is when I thought I wanted to be a doctor. Oh, you know, another long story. But anyway, the professor comes in and he said, "We're not going to talk about what's on the syllabus today. I just got a phone call from my friend Howie." My friend Howie. It's fall semester. And he said, "My friend Howie called me up and said he just got a phone call. He just got a phone call from Stockholm saying that he had won with two other collaborators that year the Nobel Prize in Medicine." My friend Howie. That he was referring to Dr. Howard Thiemann. And you can look him up, T-E-M-I-N, who won the Nobel Prize for Medicine along with two collaborators in 1975 for his work on retroviruses. So that day, instead of talking about, I don't know what the heck we were supposed to talk about, but I was having trouble getting it, I got the retrovirus thing. You know, that there's a reverse process to what every biologist had known to that point about how DNA worked. fascinating stuff, Nobel Prize winning insight and innovation, let me say. So we talked about that. And I found myself leaving class that day with a fair amount of pride that someone at my school, okay, it was in the medical school, it was in the Health Sciences Center across the street, had won, you know, the biggest prize you get in the academy, and had won the Nobel Prize for Medicine. Now, there are professors at Texas Tech in the physics department and other places that are doing, you know, Stockholm caliber work. Somebody at Texas Tech, since I've been here, discovered what's known as the top quark, a subatomic particle. I mean, that's Sheldon Cooper kind of stuff. I mean, that's a big deal. And you know, you take some kind of pride in that, that a level of research to this extent is going on at your school. And maybe if you run into that professor in class, he or she will tell you a little something about it, and you may remember it. So I'm going to talk to you about stuff that's going to get nowhere near Stockholm, and I understand that. But, you know, it's something nobody else has got, and I think it's kind of provocative. So stay tuned. This point we'll revisit a little bit when I show you some bar charts on Thursday with regard to religion and deviance. So that's in principle what, from a functionalist point of view, successful societies use their school system to accomplish, to socialize, integrate, place, track, control, with some level of deliberation, facilitate social change, but also challenge. Again, the innovative part of education involves your holding us by the throat and saying, why is that question worth asking, rather than what's the answer to that question? I am really serious about that. I harp on that almost every day. But I think that's vital. Why is that question worth asking is the question you should be asking us. So, do you have any questions? Anything you'd like me to say or comment more on or repeat? Okay. Moving to the other side of the room then. From a functionalist point of view, public education does all these great things. It also does one thing more from a conflict point of view. It reproduces social inequality. It reproduces social inequality because it promotes assimilation. It dilutes diversity. It dilutes diversity. And again, the illustrative point here is the not just the reliance upon, but the resistance to any rejoinder to the English language in school. I know people that are conversant and fluent in five languages. I can converse in German. Well, it would take me a month or two to tool it up, but I could converse fairly fluently in German if I had to. I can have a very pleasant vacation in Mexico or Spain. I know enough Spanish to get me by, or hopefully not, or at least maybe get out of trouble. Restaurants, museums, that kind of thing. I can get by in Spanish, but I'm by no means fluent. I took some remedial work. And I'm sorry about that. You know, I wish I had more of a bicultural perspective, you know, and I don't think you get that by getting a burrito at Taco Bell. It just doesn't seem to make it, you know, in the same kind of way as we spent about 10 days in central Mexico in 2005, and sadly, you know, the cultural process in that wonderful country, inhabited by terrific people, is just almost unavailable because it's so dangerous right now, and that relates to the infrastructure of illegal drugs as much as anything. But, you know, I'll never forget that, and I wish I had more of that. Learning German in high school doesn't help very much if you live in Texas. I mean, unless you live in Fredericksburg, I guess. But the dilution of diversity leaves out a lot of learning, if not formal education. A lot of learning, if not formal education. And again, my six-year-old, my favorite example down in Austin, learned a little Spanish by watching Dora the Explorer, but I think has lost most of that because she's now in American public school. And she's in a very good American public school, by the way. And yet, assimilation is more what happens than the highlighting of or the celebrating of or even the teaching of the value of diversity. Now, we certainly are doing more of that than we did in 1950, but it is still arguably The delusion of diversity promotes inequality. That's the argument. And it's also, I think, argued that if credentialism is what the schools are supposed to create, you get a credential when you're out of here. We have to develop the curriculum and criteria for a bachelor's degree. And yet, not everybody's got an equal shot at that. And it has some to do, but not all, and maybe not even most to do with intellect. In order to illustrate this, I use kind of a bizarre example. The Boston Marathon is, at least in the U.S., the most high-pressure, high-powered running race. You have to qualify for that thing, and it's not easy to do. I looked it up recently, and for someone who's in my age group, 60 and over, and you'd think that, you know, if someone was in reasonably good shape at this age, could qualify, not a chance. You have to be able to prove in a sanctioned marathon race that you can run 26 miles at something like a 7.5-minute pace. I can't run 1 mile on a 7.5-minute pace, and I exercise every day. I do that every day. There's no way. I mean, that's just almost, and don't even think about trying to qualify if you're a 20-year-old guy. I mean, you've got to run 26 miles on something like a 5 or 6 minute pace, which is unbelievably fast. But a lot of people do. Thousands upon thousands of people line up on Patriots Day in Boston and run from Hopkinton to the Boston Common. And we have this myth in America that the starting line for every kindergartner is one long line, and everybody starts at the head of that line. It's like the starting line at the Boston Marathon, which is about a block wide, but it's several hundred yards long. And the people who start the Boston Marathon with their toes on the starting line, not six blocks back, are the world's most elite runners. The fastest runners in the world start at the starting line. You'd think if it were fair, they'd put them at the back, right? No, the best runners in the world are the ones that start on the starting line. Everybody else kind of lines up. It takes folks who are barely qualifiers, and it takes a whiz-bang level of running ability just to qualify for that thing. It may take them 30, 40 minutes just to get to the starting line. Well, this film I'm going to show you in a little bit talks, and I want you to hold that metaphor in your head. It shows how students at different kinds of schools metaphorically line up at the front of the line versus at the back. So these credentials, and let's imagine for a minute that the starting line is here, and it's a block wide, and all kids in Texas line up to get that Texas Tech degree, which the bachelor's degree, you see where the molding is, where all those ones, twos, and threes are right there? The bachelor's degree is right there. If you could grab that, I guess it's not a one, two, three, it's an A, right? You can go grab that, can't see, if I just look right here. Then I have to go to that side of the room and I don't want to. If you can go over and grab that A, you can get a college degree from here. The question is, if you start, you know, six blocks back, do they still have them? Right? That's the question. So, metaphorically, that's the image on how credentials are a scarce resource. And in the quest for any scarce resource, the more you have in your bag of tricks at the starting line, the more likely you are to be able to grab that thing at the end of the race. See what I mean? There's a lot of kids that never finish the race. And we'll talk about how and why that works in this film here in a little bit. Tracking also is a selective way of bestowing status. It's not the only... A score on a standardized test is not necessarily, in fact, from this point of view, it hardly ever does or measures what it claims to measure, that is, the likelihood of success at the next level. What's interesting to me is that the people who have written and implement and score the graduate record exam, which may be the most relevant standardized test for college students seeking to get to the next level, they don't even say it's valid beyond the first semester of college, of graduate school, I mean. They will say that you can only rely on the validity of the number you get on the GRE to predict success for one semester. In other words, there's a million different variables that predict success. And while we have, to this point, fairly recently, use the GRE as a one-size-fits-all. Even the GRE inventors say you can't use it for that. It doesn't measure that. But standardized tests, again, from a conflict point of view, and educational psychologists who come at the analysis of standardized tests from this perspective will say that any standardized test, whether it's the ACT, the SAT, the TOCS test, the STAR test, whatever that is, what it does most effectively is measure conformity. In other words, it's an indicator of how we dilute diversity. It measures conformity. And at this point, I usually tell the story of a former student of mine. A grad student came through our department. She started with us in 2004, and I was her thesis advisor. She got her earned a master's degree with us. She was my research assistant on a nearly $500,000 grant, lit it up, a young African-American woman who had two kids. And in the course of her being my RA, she was also my TA for one semester, and after I had done this lecture, she came up to me and she said, I got tracked into the low reading group when I was in fourth grade. And her take on it was that it had more to do with the fact that she was female and African-American and assumptions that were placed on her at that point, which I'll talk about in a minute. Well, she wound up going to the University of Washington, which is one of America's best sociology departments, studying with some of America's best sociologists. And I believe people call her doctor now, not remedial. You know, so there. But the tests would have predicted otherwise, so it doesn't always work. So from a conflict point of view, tracking sort of reinforces what I call in just a minute a self-fulfilling prophecy. The tracking process doesn't exactly highlight the skills that are most necessary to succeed. Credentials are a scarce resource. There aren't the same number of bachelor's degrees available as there are numbers of people seeking them. And the likelihood of getting them has something to do with initiative and intellect, but it has a lot more to do with the resources you bring into Texas Tech or any other university, as much as what you do with what you get here from this argument. And from a conflict point of view, public education reinforces and promotes the dilution of diversity, which is seen as a loss from this point of view. Questions about this segment? Okay. Well, let's talk about just a couple of kids in a room, maybe 30 or 40 of them. Labeling theory argues that you become what you say you are. If you wear a label, good student. If you wear a label, stoner. If you're given a label, nerd, whatever. That you tend to live up to or down to the expectations of those around you that are associated with that label. Sometimes we cultivate even deviant labels. You know, Mark Twain said, I would not want to be a part of any group that would accept me. That's an insight that just keeps on giving. I would not want to be a part of any group that would accept me. You know, imagine groups to which you seek membership and what it takes to get that, you know, and so on. But we wear labels, and people make assumptions about us based on they're just knowing the label. That's all they have to know. I mean, you're wearing a Go In Band sweatshirt, so I'm just guessing that you're in the band. We've talked about it, but not necessarily. You know, you could have borrowed that from somebody in the band. You could have picked it up at a secondhand store. You could have stolen it. I don't know. You are in the band, right? Okay. What are you going to play on Saturday, by the way?
We're doing our Bruno Mars show.
Bruno Mars. Okay. Are you guys? See how I do this? Is the band going to do a patriotic show for the Oklahoma game? Do you know that? That's going to be cool, isn't it? Because it's the game right after Veterans Day. Right. Okay. Just checking. But you get the idea? I mean, that was a symbolic interaction, right? How come the tuba players aren't catching the football in the tuba? One of the tuba players caught the thing. He caught it in his arms. I'm going, you know what? Do you know anything about this? Are they instructed to put the tubas down?
I don't know.
Have they been told to resist this harebrained idea that your professor has? Have they been told that I've got this thing going?
I'm pretty sure they have been.
But. Pretty expensive instruments.
Oh, it's a football. It's full of air. Never mind. That's a big digression. But anyway. Assumptions are made about who we say we are. And assumptions are made about who other people say we are. That's what's intriguing to me. And I want to point you toward the summary of a series of tests of research experiments that were done by two team leaders, but the leaders of the team were Rist and Rosenthal. The Rist and Rosenthal self-fulfilling prophecy experiment. Maybe you remember when you're in like fourth grade and you get a brand new pair of jeans for school, and like 3 months later you've outgrown them because from September to November you've had this little growth spurt, etc. Well, Rist and Rosenthal contended that kids had intellectual growth spurts too. That they move along at a normal or a regular pace and then suddenly they get it and they get this, growth spurt. Well, they swooped into elementary schools with a standardized test, and this was in the 60s, and they said, we have a test that will identify in advance the kids that are on the cusp of an intellectual growth spurt. They're just about to take off, and our test will, we can spot that a little bit in advance. It's like knowing who's going to win the football game and putting a bet on them, basically, right? So they implement this test. They give back to the teachers a list, and the list involved giving them the names of roughly 20% of the students they tested. And what happened to these kids? Well, it turned out the test was right, apparently, because this 20% that were identified as on the edge of an intellectual growth spurt a year later had done better, they'd worked harder, they'd accomplished more, they tested better. What's the trick in this tale, do you think?
They just gave random names.
They just gave them random names. That's all they did. Gave them random names and created a self-fulfilling prophecy. In other words, if I say that this will happen to me, I can self-fulfill it. Or more dramatically, if other people who are really smart and are in authority say this will happen to me, first of all, they'll pay more attention to me, they'll teach me more, and I'll learn more because I think I can, right? As opposed to, oh crap, I'm in the dumb group. And low, middle, and high reading, they can call it red, white, and blue. They can call it oranges, peaches, and apples. And every kid knows whether or not they're in the dumb group, right? And that becomes okay, this is who I am. Or as opposed to, yeah, this is who I am. I'm going to go get me one, etc., right? And they're really not that much different, other than the meaning and the power of the label. Now, first of all, any questions to this point? The outline is a little bit confusing because the expectations of administrators are rooted in labeling theory, and that produces what's called a self-fulfilling prophecy. They're connected. Question.
So, if this self-fulfilling prophecy led to these good results, why mm-hmm. not implement it into the whole aspect of the education system?
Well, I think we do in some sense. And then it becomes unrealistic. We tell everybody, you can be president of the United States. Well, actually, you can't unless you're 35 years old. And actually, you can't unless you're a natural-born citizen. Don't get me started on the birthers with Obama. My colleague Nadia Flores, who came to the U.S. as an illegal immigrant at 15, can never be president of the United States. It will never happen. Might be a pretty good one. But anyway, it's a myth. Because, in point of fact, we are not all created equal. There are, we have different levels of intellect and emotion that qualify us for different things. And of course, we're supposed to figure out what that is so that by the time we're 40, you finally figured out what you wanted to be when you grew up. That's how long it took me when I got here. But you see, that's how it's supposed to work. And we can go overboard in the other way with what some have criticized as in the everyday and every way things are getting better and better. Well, realistically, they're not. Always, and not everybody can or should, even try to do brain surgery. That about the time we had that thing on the Nobel Prize in my chemistry class, like a week later, I flunked a chemistry test, and that was the end of pre-med for me. A very good idea, right? Anyway, you get the idea. What I'm going to show you here is a video that was made 20 plus years ago. And so some of the imagery in it is really old. The minimum wage that's quoted is really old. There are some Apple computers in there that should be in the antique stores. I understand all that. But what it illustrates is the disparity in simply the nature of the place where learning occurs. And it has everything to do with school funding. Because schools are funded based on property values, and property values are calculated based on the worth of the businesses and homes in the area. Before we do that, And as I set up the film, and the film will take, once it starts, about 15 minutes, take the next 3 or 4 minutes to do a Rick Perry deal. And before you listen first. It's a tweet on paper, and your Rick Perry question, or your Rick Perry tweet is, my self-fulfilling prophecy. I'm going to give myself today a self-fulfilling prophecy. You give yourself a self-fulfilling prophecy. What is it? My self-fulfilling prophecy. Make it happen. Declare it today.
Becker doesn't want to play.